is Representative Kelly, Co-Chairman Schnault, myself, Chairman Meyer, Vice Chairman Stokes, Representative Tula, and Representative Hawker. On today's schedule, we have three bills. Two of them will be combined. First one's House Bill 380, Animals and Animal Agricultural Products, and then the second one is Senate Bill 218 and House Bill 353. They are Senate and House companion bills. It looks like the Senate Bill 218 is kind of in the lead, so we'll be taking Senate Bill 218. But we also have the sponsor here for 353. So anyway, we'll be hearing both of those. So let's go ahead and get started. We'll start with House Bill 380, Animals and Animal Product, or Agricultural Products. Let's see, yeah. Mr. Filosofy, if you want to come to the table, let's see. I think I need a motion, though. I do need a motion to adopt committee's substitute.
We have a blank. Mr. Chairman, I make the motion to adopt a blank committee substitute for HB 380, version 24/LS1469/Y, Bannister 22706 is a working document before the committee.
Thank you, Representative Schnell. Any objections? Okay. Seeing none, we have that before us. Okay. And presenting this will be Mike Kowalski, who's my staff. Kowalski, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Kowalski, and I'm an aide to Representative Meyer. What I think I'd like to do is to begin with a overview of the idea behind House Bill 380, some of the problems that exist in the current statutes, and then to talk about what happens in the blank CS and where those ideas came about. But to begin with, House Bill 380 is the product of a working group over the interim between the Department of Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game, Natural Resources, and the Division of Agriculture. The idea behind 380 is to repeal and reenact powers of the Department of Environmental Conservation and the statutes that authorize the state veterinarian. Most of these powers were passed in 1949 and have been tweaked moderately since then, and do not reflect the threats that face Alaskans and our animals and humans today. The primary problem is that the definition of an animal has usually been limited to livestock, and that worked well in the 40s when animals, by and large, were livestock. But as our experiences with animals expand, we have more pets and domestic bird flocks, it's become more and more problematic to have the authority for the department to take appropriate action when it relates to these animals. The dilemma arises particularly when we talk about emerging zoonotic diseases, and those are diseases that can come from animals to humans or diseases within animal populations. And so we will have the state veterinarian here to talk about the overall need for the legislation. With any piece of legislation, there are problems that come up throughout the drafting and the discussion process. And prior to the committee today, we've heard back from a lot of the agricultural communities between the Resources Committee substitute and the blank committee substitute that you hear and see in front of you today. And I will highlight the changes for you so that you can anticipate and see some of the dialogue that we've gone through and that you should hear today from testimony. The first and primary change is on page 2, and that would be lines 28 through 31. And what that does is it talks about when the department adopts regulations to implement the powers granted in this section. The commissioner shall give substantial weight to the typical practices and standards in the state and the United States of the industry for which the regulations are designed. The issue that came up is that in granting authorities that were largely pre-existing in statute, the concern is you re-raise the opening of regulations and regulatory powers. When, as you see throughout the bill, things relate to the sanitary conditions an animal might be transported in or something, how a product is regulated, the concern was brought to us that standard industry practices when related to livestock can be a messy thing, and you do not want to open the door for an unnecessary shutdown of typical industry practices. So loading cattle onto a truck could be dirty and just muddy and determined by someone else to be unsanitary, but we want the state veterinarian making real decisions based on the typical industry practices. So that's just a statement of policy to the department. The second change highlights one of the most difficult parts about this bill, and that's in Section 3. And this was granting the powers to inspect a premises. Now, Title III is complicated because it is it's a section that is governed jointly by the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Department of Natural Resources. And the key between the two departments is what products they regulate. DEC has the oversight of animals or animal products, and Department of Natural Resources has oversight over agricultural products. What we've done is, in the concern about diseases, there was a lot of discussion at the Resources Committee level about how almost quasi-police powers are necessary to quarantine in the event of an emergency. And so in the original Resources Committee substitute, the lines on page 3, lines 22 and 23, on any business day during the usual hours of business was repealed to allow the inspection of a premises at any time in the event of an emergency. What we've done instead in the CS is returned on any business day during the usual hours of business to the language and added the following sentence, or at any time if the commissioner determines that there is an immediate threat to the health or safety of an animal or the general public. And that was to say that outside of business hours, in the event of an immediate threat, you could inspect a premises. But we didn't want to open it up too unnecessarily. Mr. Chairman, those are essentially the main changes. There was some change to page 2, lines 21 and 22, but since there is, I believe, an amendment that will be forthcoming to talk about the fee issue, I'd prefer to bring that up at that time. And with that, Mr. Chairman, those are the major changes in the CS, and with that, I'd answer any questions from the committee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pulaski. Any questions? Representative Stoltz.
Thank you. I expected my former valley colleague here to take a lead on bovine issues. I have a question on Section 4. Normally we just designate the powers of the commissioner. Why is it specifically specified that powers can be delegated? It's usually just assumed that the commissioner has the power to delegate, but they are ultimately responsible. Maybe you can explain that way.
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, I understand that is related to the state veterinarian, that in the way the role of the commissioner and the state veterinarian interacts within the bill, particularly I turn you to page 2, lines 23 through 26, that there has a lot to do with the actual role of designating an authority, and I would turn to the department to answer why that was important as a structural working within the bill.
Mike, I can wait for Mr. Gerlach when he testifies. Okay.
Very good.
Any other questions at this time from Mr. Pulaski? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Pulaski. We do have some people online to testify, and I think one of them can answer your question, Representative Stoltz. Before we get started, I want to welcome Representative Moses, Representative Foster, and Representative Wyrick. Okay, let's see. Why don't we go ahead and start here in Juneau with Mr. Gerlach. Bob Gerlach, the state veterinarian. Sir, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Gerlach. I am the state veterinarian for Alaska. In the this bill was introduced to look at what we have as a disease, a problem in the world today, is that we used to categorize diseases according to diseases of livestock versus wildlife versus humans versus pets. We know that those categories aren't appropriate. We know that diseases that are in the newspapers today that we've all heard about cross these boundaries, these categories and diseases like Lyme's disease, West Nile virus, avian influenza, SARS can be transmitted by animals to human beings, by pets to livestock to human beings, so that we can't look at diseases as we had in the past. We know that these diseases can be transmitted not only through contact with animals, but also through contact with animal products. So restricting authority to specific categories of animals would leave both livestock and wildlife susceptible to threats from other animal groups, such as pets or exotic animals that are in wildlife displays or at zoos. So authority needed to be addressed to protect those wildlife and animal resources, as well as the public health resources of the state. We know that these diseases have great impact on any entity, whether it's a state or a national government or global economy. We've got public health threats, we've got animal resource threats, and we have economic threats, such as what had been brought up in Italy, for example, with the avian influenza epidemic. Within 2 weeks after that, avian influenza was diagnosed in two farms in southern Italy. They went ahead and depopulated several farms, and basically they put 30,000 people out of work. So that these diseases have great, great impact on the economy and on the resources of the state. We have diseases that can be transmitted, like I said, through other routes that we aren't commonly associated or thinking about, in the fact that diseases, not only avian influenza, but diseases like cod cholera, African swine fever, foot and mouth disease, can be transmitted on products. That's why, as you come into this country, you're asked on the airport to identify on a questionnaire if you've been on any farms, if you have any agricultural products or animal products that you're bringing into the state or into the country that you can possibly bringing these diseases in. So we're trying to expand the authority to protect the livestock industry, protect the animals on these farms from threats that are due to the industry, as like I said, as well as our human resources and human public health to protect that. I can give two examples in the last 2 years. One was out in Kodiak. We had a disease impact several horses out at the fairgrounds there. The horses got sick, and within 24 hours, 12 to 24 hours, were dead. This was after they were identified by the owner. Veterinarian was called in. They were treated. The animals died. By the time the third horse passed away, they called my office. We started an investigation, and through the work with the local veterinarian and the owners out there, we're able to gather some information. And on the third day of that investigation, after the fourth horse had then died, we ended up having a child get sick out on the island that had to be airbagged into Anchorage. At this point, we had to do something because we weren't even sure what was causing the disease in the horses. We had no idea if it had any public health effect or impact. We ended up working cooperatively with the Coast Guard, with the air carriers, with the ferry system to stop all animal movement on and off the island. And we were able to do that and to at least secure that part of the disease investigation so we wouldn't allow the disease, if it was possibly a contagious or infectious disease, to get off the island. We didn't have the authority to stop animal movements such as exotics or its pets, but with the cooperation of the owners and with people, the carriers, we were able to accomplish that until we were able to identify the cause of the problem and deal with that. The second example was just happened this last summer. Out in the valley, we had a importer bring in about 500 ducks for some field trials using with dogs. Within the first 2 weeks after the animals had been brought into the state, 200 of these ducks had already died. And as you know, this was the time period where avian influenza was heating up and had impacted left China and was going back down into Malaysia and Indonesia. We had no idea what had caused the death of these ducks, and we had no authority because they're not poultry, they're not livestock. They were birds that were brought in for field trials. Working with the USDA, with public health, and with the some other state agencies, as well as the voluntary cooperation of the bird owner, we were able to quarantine the area, do some bird testing, determine what the cause of the disease was, and then resolve the problem, and able to allow that producer then to start his field trials that next week. But without that, if those field trials were allowed to go on and birds released or exposed to other people or other animals, we have the potential for a problem. I can answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much for your follow-up on that. So we have a question from Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Dr. Gerlach. And I just had a question about, on Section 4, it's where it says the commissioner or the individual designated by the commissioner, is that intended to be the state veterinarian for all practical purposes?
I'm sorry, I missed the reference to what part?
Section 4 on page 4.
An authorized inspector. That would be essentially me to go ahead and be the inspector, but in area or in time periods where I would be unable to attend to an area, whether I was in Anchorage and we had a disease outbreak in Nome or in some other area, we would be able to designate an appropriate authority to go ahead and do an investigation. This would be through other trained people within the state, either fish and game biologists possibly, or through local veterinarians that would be, or through USDA veterinarians to go ahead and be able to do the investigation and do that work.
Well, thank you, that, Mr. Chairman, that explanation. I wouldn't necessarily want one of the political appointees here being designated that, but as long as that's real clear on the record, with all due respect to those folks, but I, as you've explained it, the folks we're dealing with chronic wasting disease, I can see where Mr. Rope, just from the Division of Game, I guess it's wildlife something now, but the Bill Division of Game would have the expertise to interact on something with an elk problem or a reindeer problem. So that makes sense as you've explained it.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Any other questions for our state veterinarian? Okay. Seeing none right now, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just so people know, we do have people available for questions if we get through the public testimony here. Kristen Ryan, Director of DE, Division of Environmental Health, and Matt Robus, Director of Division of Wildlife Conservation.
Conservation.
Okay, so let's now go to Sabrina Fernandez. Did you want to testify? Are you available for questions, or not quite sure?
I'm just available for questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Steve Mulder.
Likewise, I'm available for questions.
Great. Okay. Yes, it does. I just have names here. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we're both with the Department of Law.
Okay. Let's see. I've got Arisa Castrodeo, Division of Public Health.
Hi, I'm on the phone. Is that okay for me to talk now?
Yes.
Great. My name is Louisa Castrodeo. I work for the Section of Epidemiology, and I'd just like to testify on behalf of Dr. Richard Monsager, who's the Director of the Division of Public Health. And we're in full support of this bill. We'd like to express that. Our office works very closely with the State Veterinarian's Office, and it's very essential for us in human health to be confident in animal quarantine and isolation authorities. And so we fully support Dr. Gerlach and this bill.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you for calling in. Okay, next is Rob Arnold.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. I'm Rod Arno. I'm speaking for the Alaska Outdoor Council, and our 10,000 members statewide depend on a wild food harvest, and we're concerned about the health of that harvest, and the Outdoor Council does support the passage of House Bill 380. And also, with Section 7 dealing with wild or domestic, and including birds, fish, and mammals, that's what our membership eats as a wild food harvest, that we do want to make sure that the state is actively supporting the health of that. And also by having the state veterinarian with the Department of Environmental Conservation take this over, that'll take a little pressure off of the Division of Wildlife Conservation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Let's see, then finally we have Larry DeBilbis.
Yeah, am I online?
Yes, you are, sir.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chairman. I'm Larry DeBilbis, the Director of Agriculture. We worked closely with DEC on this throughout last winter, and we do support it. It's an improvement because it clarifies our roles. Basically speaking, the Department of Agriculture is responsible for plant health, and the DEC is responsible for animal health, and we've been kind of handling all the fuzzy areas by MOU and understanding over the years, but in a crisis that could slow things down. So I think this is important, and Dr. Gerlach's stories about the ducks reminds me of our incident with a case of fowl brood in some bees up here last summer, and we had to go through quarantine and actual burn the facilities. And so there are times when we need to step in and take action to keep things from getting worse. I just support this and appreciate your taking it up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. DeBilbis. Appreciate your testifying today. Any questions for Mr. DeBilbis? Okay. Seeing none, that's all I have on teleconference to testify. Is there anybody here in the audience yet that would like to testify on this? Yeah, okay. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close testimony. As I mentioned, we have several people available for questions, if there are any questions. If not, we'll go ahead and...
Question from Ms. Ryan, I think.
Ms. Ryan? Kristen, can you join us, please? We have a... Representative Stoltz has a question for you.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ryan, it's just... I've attended numerous events related to... funding for through the Federal Agricultural Farm Bill, and I've always seen commercial fishermen as active participants in that trough. And why are they specifically exempted from the regulation? If they want to be called agriculture, why are they exempted when they certainly want to call themselves? I hear anytime there's money available, the commercial fishing industry says, well, we're farming. With all due respect to my friends there, just trying to be consistent, but regarding that. But they're always saying, well, we are really in agriculture, except we don't like farming. You know, it's help me with this, why they, if they want to get to the farm trough, why they shouldn't also be regulated.
Representative Stoltz, through the chair, it might be a better question for Director DeBilbis, since he is the one who regulates agricultural products. We did include fish in our definition of animal products because that's one of those gaps we felt we needed to cover. While Fish and Game regulates fish, wild fish, no one had the authority to regulate domestic fish, which may seem kind of bizarre, but there could at some point be a disease vector in fish brought in fish tanks that's released into the wild. So that was one of the reasons why we worked with Fish and Game to include fish in our definition, even though they have the dominant authority in that area. But the division of definition of agricultural products does not include fish, and that would be a question for Larry DeBilbis.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just will just send a message out to Larry. I'm just still frustrated. When we had the Farm Bill presentation most recently out at the Palmer Depot, our farmers were way behind the line, and a lot of them didn't get to testify because all the alternative energy folks, all the commercial fishermen from around the state, and some of our longest tenured farmers out there weren't at the table. So that's, I guess, I'm more frustrated, and I'll not waste any more of the committee's time. It's more. I'm still frustrated by incidents like that, and we'll just go on.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Kristen. Mr. Pulaski, would you please join us? Okay. Okay, we'll go ahead and if there's no other questions, we'll go ahead with amendments. Question?
Just
Commissioner Kelly, sure.
Either for Mike or for the state vet. If we looked at a list of the things that we need to do to respond in such a reasonable fashion to the potential threat from avian flu, are we working off of a list that somebody's keeping track of that we're going to take 20 steps and this is 1 of 20 or is this 7 of 20 or what? How does this fit into a context regarding the evening news last night?
Representative Kelly, through the chair, I'd ask Dr. Gerlach to assist me in the answer, but as I understand it, this allows us to, the concern largely is that it's those gaps in authority where there's no oversight, no testing, no ability to get in, where diseases slip through the cracks. And this is a major part of that effort to close those gaps so that our veterinarian at the state level, working with local veterinarians and the entirety of the state response infrastructure, could find out about the disease in time to begin a response. But this is the reason Representative Meyer has worked on this a lot. It's that beginning step where if you don't know there's a disease, you can't respond to it. And if you don't have the authority to respond to it, it has the potential of spreading and creating a much bigger problem than we would have originally had to deal with.
Just follow on.
Hey, Dr. Gerlach, you want to go ahead and join us here?
I would say the avian Bob Gerlach, state veterinarian. Avian influenza is a good example to look at with respect to this bill, but this bill is also to attend to other diseases. In particular, we could name several others, but even the most recent one was monkeypox that was introduced into the United States in the import of avian rats from Africa. It intermixed with other animals at a pet store, and from that pet store, then the pets disseminated that infection to a number of people throughout the Midwest. The concern was is that not that this disease was going to kill people, but it had the presentation very similar to smallpox. But we had a situation where no state veterinarian in those Midwest states had the authority to go in and deal with prairie dogs and these avian rats that were transmitting the disease. So this bill gives us the first step in many of the diseases that we might look at as being a problem. If avian influenza had been introduced into the United States through in a pet bird or in Alaska in a pet bird, then we would have problems in dealing with that outbreak right now. In most cases, people are very in tune to voluntarily helping to do the surveillance for it, as we found out last year when we went to the state fairs to test for the virus. Even though finding the virus would mean the people losing their birds and having their houses quarantined, people are willing to go ahead and do that. But in cases where we just can't rely on voluntary cooperation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Any other questions while we have the state veterinarian here?
Okay. I just have a quick
sure,
question. This is not a. Is there any circumstance where you would regulate rodents and gerbils in a gaming activity at the fair?
No.
Representative Saltz through the chair. There would be if those animals carried a disease that would impact people, or the possibility would impact other livestock that would be at that fair. And that's a fair question, and unfortunately, there are diseases that rodents carry that can have great impact on the livestock resources that would be at the fair.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and go to amendments, and I'll move Amendment 1.
Yes.
Okay, it's been moved and objected to. Mr. Pulaski, if you could explain the amendment.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number 1 came out of work this morning with Representative Holm, who couldn't be here today, so I offered to speak on the amendments. The concern was to page 2, lines 21 and 22, that the fee authority was too broad in the repeal and reenact, and that In the situation where a quarantine was initiated by the state had the ability to charge fees to the person who was having their business, home, or livestock quarantined to perform that service, and that seemed inappropriate. So we went back to the actual language in the existing statute that was being repealed and reenacted and kept fees, charges, credit provisions for services related to animals and animal products rendered by state veterinarians to farmers and others at their request. And the key being is that our state lab does a lot of testing at the request of a farmer or a person, and that the department needs the authority to charge a fee for that service when it's at the request of someone, but shouldn't be able to initiate an activity and then charge fees to private citizens.
Okay, any questions? The department is okay with this amendment, is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
I'll remove my objection. Okay, the objection has been removed. Any other objections to Amendment 1? Okay. Amendment 1 passes. Amendment 2, I'll move Amendment 2 for Representative Horn.
Object.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmes' staff noticed that if you look at Amendment Number 1, lines 7 and 8, because Amendment Number 1 has passed and already includes the words related to animals or animal products, the amendment on line 7 of 8 of Amendment Number 2 is unnecessary and wouldn't gel with the Amendment Number 1. So in moving the amendment, I'd advise the committee to delete lines 7 and 8 and make the amendment conceptual. And then I could speak to it.
Can you repeat that again?
Sure. We've now changed lines 21 and 22 on page 2 with amendment number 1.
Okay.
And amendment number 2 was drafted assuming that the old lines 21 and 22 existed. So those don't relate anymore since we've already taken care of it.
Okay.
And so I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, but I believe that we'd have to just scratch out 7 and 8 on Amendment Number 2 and then offer a amended Amendment Number 2.
Okay. Okay, I'll move to amend the amendment by deleting lines 7 and 8. Is there any objections to that? Okay, so now we have Amendment 2 as amended in front of us.
And Mr. Chairman, what Amendment Number 2 does is simply, as we've talked about, the distinction in jurisdiction hinges on animals or animal products versus agricultural products. This is more clarifying language throughout the bill that Representative Holm felt would help tighten up the legislation, and the department had no problem with it.
Okay, very good. Any questions concerning Amendment 2 as amended?
I'll remove my objection.
Okay, the objection has been removed. Any other objections? Seeing that, Amendment 2 as amendment passes. Okay, now we have the bill before us. Fiscal notes, I believe there's one, but it was zero, is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
All right. Anything else concerning the bill or the fiscal notes? Seeing none, Representative Foster?
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move this. HB 380. Fly out of this committee with the tax fiscal notes and the budget recommendation.
Okay. Any objections to the bill passed in the committee? Seeing none? Thank you, Bill. Passed this committee. Thank you, Mr. Pulaski, Representative Foster.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. We want to go ahead and take up the next bill for the committee.
I really want to say that's one of the best bills I've ever seen.
All right. Thank you, Representative Foster.
And that's a new one. I only saw at least four committee members fall asleep during that one.
Okay, we're still online here, okay? Okay, I believe we have Representative Newman here, and we have Senator Bundy. Senate Bill 218, criminal sentencing. And we're going to have Senator Bundy and Representative Newman, because as I mentioned earlier, these are companion bills, Senate Bill 218 and House Bill 315. 3 are the same bills. The Senate bill is the vehicle because it's further along than the House bill. Since we have both of the sponsors here, I'd like to give time to both of them to introduce the bill. To go ahead and represent it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Finance Committee. I also want to thank Senator Bundy and Senators Guest for their hard work on this issue. And it's a real bipartisan unicameral issue here, that in an effort that we're trying to make Alaska a better place. Most importantly, I want to thank the grandmother who came to my office this last spring and expressed her concerns about the sentencing laws in Alaska. And through those investigations, I've learned quite a bit, and it's left something inside of me that it's very difficult to explain. But I want to share a few of the statistics that Alaska has in sexual crimes. I'm not going to go through all these. We're going to make sure that the members of the committee have this information.
Senator Guest, you want to join us, please? Okay. Thank you, Senator Guest. Go ahead.
Senator Guest.
Excuse me for the interruption.
But Alaska ranks first in rape per capita in the United States. One forcible rape every 15.25 hours. There's over 4,300 registered sex offenders in the state of Alaska. These are, we talk about the price. I know that people are concerned about the cost of what this bill may be, but Alaska's cost of victimization, just with the 521 victims, it averages about $86,500 per victim. That's over $45 million a year just in victim costs in itself. I think if we can contain these, it's going to greatly increase those efforts. Only 16% of the victims in the Rape in America study reported their rapes. And along with rapes, I had a conversation with Commissioner Tandesky, and I asked the commissioner somewhere along the lines, people who are willing to create or to get involved with this type of a crime probably don't care too much about other crimes that they do. And he said, yeah, somewhere along there. So we got some statistics up. The average number of times of other crimes admitted to the Department of Corrections was 11.75 times. So they've created, been involved in 11 other types of crimes of theft and robbery and those other types of crimes. So I guess the bottom line in that conversation is, when we're putting these people away for a longer time for sexual assaults, we're also putting them away, getting them off the streets from a lot of other crimes that they've committed. And the longer I've worked on this bill, it's some of the information is just, it's almost unbearing for me. The average sex offender averages 110 victims and 318 offenses before they get caught. And when you go back to the statistics that only 16% of the victims report that rape, you can do a little bit of multiplication in your head. It's the amount of crimes that are being committed right now in our state. And again, I think this is a very high priority. It's an epidemic in Alaska that we need to look at, and we need to put the brakes on this right now. And at this time, I'd like to refer to Senator Bundy or Senator Guest for some of their comments.
Senator Bundy, do you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, Con Bundy, Senate District P, and Representative Newman laid out the issue, I think, very well. It is truly a bipartisan issue, with Senator Guest's help on the Senate side, and with Representative Newman's help on this side, it became a unicameral issue. And as was pointed out, this problem is certainly big enough for all of us to be involved in and concerned about. While we have some outrageous statistics with the number of sexual offenders in Alaska and then the amount of crime, it is really only the tip of the iceberg, as you might imagine. People that are involved in crimes like this, the victims are very hesitant to come forward. And so what we're dealing with is an even larger problem than is apparent. I distributed to a number of your offices maps with the number of sexual offenders who had to report in the area. And at least on the in the House Judiciary Committee, the highest number so far within about a mile radius of a elected representative was over 1,000 registered sex offenders. Whereas fortunately, some people live in some areas, Representative Stoltz, where maybe they have found an old-fashioned way to deal with the problem, but they don't have near as many as offenders there. I also want to acknowledge the terrific help we've gotten from all our staffs in working on this, and as I've already heard them referred to previously, the P squared people, Ms. Parks and Portia from Department of Corrections and Department of Law, who've been very instrumental in helping us. Now they took care of the details; they took care of the legal aspects. Those of us sitting here today have to take care of the public policy aspects, and that's what this is about. It institutes some really long sentences, but we had some very poignant testimony in the House Judiciary where a victim of sexual assault, that an assault that occurred some 30 plus years ago, is still troubled by it. And so the victims end up in many times with a life sentence. And the sad but true fact is there's a high rate of recidivism and there's very little change in the behavior. We have tried various programs to change behavior and it just doesn't seem to work. So in order to protect the women and children in our society, at this time, the most reasonable solution are long prison terms, and these are long prison terms. Would like to point out that some folks will say, well, these people were under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Mr. Chairman, I doubt that any time recently you've consumed too much alcohol to affect your judgment, but perhaps when you were young, if you did, I doubt there was enough alcohol in the world to make you want to have sex with a young child. And alcohol may reduce inhibitions. Drugs may reduce inhibitions. They do not talk us into doing something that we're not predisposed to do. So I don't think drugs and alcohol is an adequate excuse. I don't think tradition or culture is an adequate excuse. And I don't think the notion that there will be more trials or that we're going to end up with more people in prison is an adequate excuse. It's true. This bill may cost money. It costs money to incarcerate people, but then it costs money to have a civil society where women and children have adequate protection. I also want to address an issue that came up in judiciary. Well, this is part of a national hysteria that's going on. You probably heard in the press about Jessica's Law, where a person who is supposed to be a registered sex offender abused and then buried alive a small girl. Sad but unfortunately true in our case. I've been working on this for several years after someone I knew had been assaulted. Senator Guest has been working on this for a long time when some of her peers when they were younger were victims of people in authority who used their authority to assault them sexually. Senator Dyson added to this bill as well, and his reputation for caring for abused children is well known and has been long and existed for a long time. So I reject the notion that we're somehow having a hysterical reaction. I think what we're having is a chance to address a problem that is perhaps overdue and been a long time coming. In addition to long sentences, this bill also requires the use of a polygraph for people who are on probation and parole. Research has shown that those that are subject to polygraph testing when they're on probation and parole, their compliance with the requirements of probation and parole go up almost 70%. Unfortunately, maybe it's fortunate in the long run, but when they're under the strictures of the polygraph testing, we also find that they have far more victims than we ever thought existed, or that they would acknowledge when they went through a criminal proceeding. So, Mr. Chairman, the subject is big enough we could spend a lot of time discussing this. I don't want to take more of your time. I'd like to turn over to Senator Guest for comments. We do have some experts here that can also help us with questions that you may have. So thank you for your time.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Bundy. Senator Guest. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For the record, Gretchen Guest represent Senate District J. And one of the co-sponsors of the bill, it did roll in some of the work that I did on the SAM provisions in the Senate side. And the co-sponsors are myself, Senator Dyson, Senator Elton, Kukesh, Olson, Hoffman, and Seekins. One of the reasons I read that list and I read in Judiciary is in my sixth year and we came in together, I think this is as diverse of support that didn't have everyone's support on the bill, if you think about the group, both on party and region, along with the administration that I've seen. And Senator Green also is a co-sponsor. I'd like to specifically talk about values, because that's how I see the bill, as it's a matter of policy and it's a matter of values. Sex crimes, in my opinion, and Mr. Chair, you know, because we sat on the STAR board together, have always been undervalued. Rape and molestation have been cases that, unfortunately, in our history, we've talked about as a family matter or a community matter, or, unfortunately, what did she do to matter. And it really is only fairly recently that we've started to actually see what these crimes are, which are intentional acts. You don't, you know, look the other way and accidentally molest or rape someone. I mean, these are intentionally violent crimes against folks that are devastating to them. And, you know, at the same time, if we look back at the statutes, when I really started looking at the statutes, and it was amazing to me that I hadn't before, about how low the punishments are, and do those punishments really reflect the values on our community, and do they reflect the values and the seriousness of these very intentional violent crimes? And I don't think they do, and I think this bill addresses them. It is the case that my bill, the bill that started over in the Senate side, was a lot harsher, and if I had my way, this bill would be as well. There have been compromises along the way. But I really do think, because of the history of sex crimes and how we've dealt with sexual assault and sexual molestation, that we're behind on catching up sentencing with the actual crime and with the actual values in our community. There's been a lot of discussion, especially in House Judiciary and in the halls, about the second and the third degree sex crimes. Well, you're just being way too harsh on the second and third degree sex crimes. I would, remind the members that these there are some crimes of penetration. They are all the crimes of molestation and incest. So they are very serious crimes when you look at the list of what falls into the second and the third degree. It's often, and it's been, for me, unfortunate to listen to testimony both on the Senate and the House side that this is, you know, a drunk guy who grabs my breast in a bar and you're going to send him away. That's not what these crimes are. This is the 4-year-old who gets fondled over their underwear. I mean, that's the distinction that we're talking about. The difficulty, if when you look at the law, is that sexual contact means knowingly touching directly or through clothing the victim's genitals, anus, or female breast, or knowingly causing the victim to touch directly or through clothing the defendant's or victim's genitals, anus, or female breast. I've asked the department, and we've been working on, is there a way to distinguish between the bar scene and the 4-year-old? And unfortunately, there isn't kind of a carve-out for the bar scene. And what Ms. Parks is going to address today is how we address those situations within our system now. Because those situations now have an automatic jail time, and we don't put the guy at the bar into jail. They normally go to harassment, because that's what it is. I wish there was a carve-out, honestly, because this argument is amazingly offensive to me. And it's not the case. It's not the case in the current system. And it is one of those that were caught in definitional problems, not in reality. So I guess I would ask the House and I would ask this committee, because this is, I guess, how I felt with the testimony in both Senate Finance and House Judiciary, is that we're punishing kind of the victims of molestation because of this extreme example out there where no one can come in and say there's this actual case, or it didn't go to harassment, or the system is broken in these cases. And so therefore, let's reduce the sentences on all molestation because we can't deal with it. And I think that's the wrong policy and the wrong message to send. Again, the issue of molestation and incest, I think, are very serious. I think they warrant both the minimums in the bill, but also the ranges. There was a reason why the ranges on second and third degree are so wide. The previous ranges were very small. It's a range of activity, unfortunately, that happens under these. And so that's why in this bill we decided to really expand the range to give flexibility within the judicial system on the nuances, unfortunately, that happen with molestation and incest. Another issue that has come up in other committees, and I just wanted to make clear because it was confusing up to the Senate floor on the other side, is that SAM 3, sexual abuse of minor 3, is not in this bill. These are the cases of the senior in high school making out with their freshman girlfriend. They're not in the sentencing guidelines now. They were purposely left out in Senator French's bill. And it's because these are difficult situations to deal with. They're not included in this bill. Some people have wanted to include those, and they are not. So I just wanted to put that on the record because there's been confusion in other committees, and it's hard when you read through the bill. So with that, I have to apologize to the committee because I'm not going to be able to stay the entire time. And I don't like to do that when I'm up in committee, but I have a small conflict. But I appreciate you hearing this bill, and I hope that you will see fit to see its purpose and intent. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Guest. Do we have questions for the sponsors?
Well, just while Senator Guest is here, I want to thank her for all the work, and she's been tenacious from the lobbying in the legislative cafeteria throughout, just keeping me up to date on this, as well as Senator Bundy and Representative Newman, and it's caused me to listen to follow a lot of the debate in the other committees, and I appreciate your sensitivity and offense at some of the examples, some of it, the committee testimony. It almost seems like they were treating it like a jury trial. I think the people picked a pretty good jury panel for you here, and I hope we get a good verdict for you.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz. I do have a question for Senator Guest. You mentioned your original work or bill had stiffer penalties, and now was this modified just due to the art of compromise, or is it modified due to financial reasons, or can you explain the differences and why?
My bill focused on sexual abuse of a minor, and only sexual abuse of a minor, not the sexual assault ranges. We started higher, we went higher on all of the ranges, and it was, I think, art of compromise. It was trying to understand some of the kind of other crimes that are out there. I think Senator Bundy's bill does a good job at expanding all sexual assault, not just sexual abuse of a minor. And I think when you do that, sometimes there's a little bit of give and take in those. It is the case that moving up some of the sexual abuse of a minor provisions that were in my bill or in this bill, especially trying to make it so sexual abuse of minor crimes that have to deal with penetration, that have to deal with rape, are all in the first and the second degree. So attempting to do those are all in the first or second or third degree. So we're not getting attempted rape of a child in any case into the misdemeanor range, which I think is really important. Anytime you work on a bill with as many co-sponsors with the administration and somewhere else, I agree with all the changes. We did on the second degree go from 10 to 15 years, which was originally to 5 to 15, which I would still like to see the minimum higher given the crimes that are in the second degree. And it was the case that Senate Finance went from 3 years to 1 year on third degree, which I'm still uncomfortable with, given the crimes, especially the crimes against children that can be in those. But this is so much better than our current law, especially in widening the ranges on the lower end to allow some of the people that do these crimes under this to go to jail, to be on probation, and to be polygraphed. It's all really a system. So I appreciate it.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I might just weigh in on your question there as well, it is kind of humorous to note that when Senator Jess and I worked on that, she was the hanging judge and I was a little less perhaps working against my usual reputation about being more severe. But it was not only a matter of compromise. As you know, any bill that goes through is going to require 11 and 21 votes, and it was a matter of compromise without losing the original intent of the bill, which I think Senator Guess has indicated we haven't done. And there was another issue of proportionality that will probably come up in your discussions, and that is, are we having someone convicted of a sex crime treated more harshly than someone who's convicted of attempted murder? And that is a fair discussion that we have to have. I would just add that when we talk about sentencing, it accomplishes several things. One, of course, it puts people in jail for long periods of time. They can't have new victims. And when Senator Guest mentioned rape of someone under the age of 13, it's going to be a 25-year minimum sentence. So I think even she and I agree that's pretty strict. Other things that sentencing does, of course, is it sends a very clear message of societal standards. And I think in that message, it helps people understand, well, even though I've had a couple of beers and I'm this 15-year-old's coach and she looks older tonight, I'm going to think second or third or fourth time about what my behavior should be. And so I just wanted to make sure that it was clear that as we made our compromises, I still think, and I hear some of yes, it's way better than what we have now, and you're going to hear people probably tell you that it's far too severe as it is.
Chair, if I may. When I first introduced 353, again, our concern was more of a proportionality situation of when we thought this may be challenged further in court. Through those discussions with law and corrections, we've gone over to change these. And when we looked at proportionality, they were within 1 or 2 years either higher or lower than what these bills or these sentencings are right now, except for maybe on the higher end. And I agree with Senator Bundy and also with Senator Guest that these crimes are a lifetime crime against the victims. And just where do we want to draw the line on that and how sentencings are done? Also, I didn't have the polygraphs in mind originally, but after discussions with, because I was afraid of the fiscal note on it, but after discussions with corrections, it was explained to me that Those are done twice a year. They cost around $200, and the court can order the perpetrator to pay for those. So that's not something that the state's going to have to bear. So that's why I was more than happy to put those into mind. That, and it puts some teeth into this bill. And it makes it so that sexual offenders actually start to comply with what's going on, and it's a crucial part of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. New. Representative Kelly?
Just a question if the member wishes to tackle it. One of the side benefits I can see from this would the law goes away and it's hidden in one of these books for the average citizen, and you can see a lot of folks that would get first involved with this wouldn't know what's in this book. Have you taken any steps to show the public that we respect our children, we respect our women, we respect our kids? Something that put, you know, we've got a smoke anti-smoking ban, and you watch that woman disintegrate in front of your face. There's a strong message there, and it seems to have an effect out there. Are we doing anything on that as far as public education goes to say, this is, if you just touch down in Alaska, you probably ought to get a return ticket right now because this is the toughest place you're going to land, or one of the toughest places, and we want you on notice right here and now. Is any of that in this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelly, or Representative Kelly, not that I'm aware of, no. Where it specifically says there will be X notice put out. However, in a less direct way, I think it's there. We've had a lot of press coverage and interest, and this is not a bill that will get stuck away in the law books and be ignored. There will be a considerable amount of information if and when you folks choose to pass this that the public has indicated what its standards are now. And just like our sex offender registration law, the person who gets off the airplane doesn't know about that unless they've been involved in the system before. And I do know that I heard from Department of Corrections that there were people in other states who wanted to serve their parole in Alaska because we currently do not have the polygraph. And there were people in Alaska who were asking to move to another state and then say, no, I can't go there because I can't handle that polygraph intrusion. So I suspect, like in a lot of cases, there's a subculture of this activity in many cases. And the information will spread very quickly through that subculture. The average guy getting off the airplane, woman, shouldn't have to know about it because they aren't going to be raping and molesting.
Just because I mean, when you look at the numbers and the stats in here, 13 to 16 times for 110 victims and things like that, I don't think it quite gets. It doesn't say that in Alaska we've taken almost a polar step here, which is what I think this is meant to be, and I support that.
If I might, it comes to mind, and I was thinking statewide, but it comes to mind in Anchorage, there have been public service announcements about being careful in the bar and streets you're walking in the dark and that sort of thing. Of course, we talked to folks in the administration. Again, I suspect once they have this vehicle, it will be used.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman,
do you have a follow-up? Yes, Chair, through the Chair. Representative Kelly, I also feel that, it's been mentioned that there may be a certain amount of national media hype that's going along with this. And I do think when Alaska jumps on board with this, that it will get more recognition of what does happen out there. And as like Senator Bundy so eloquently suggested, is well, the average person out there probably doesn't have to deal with this. I know that's why it was so shocking when the further I dug into this and started coming into these facts, how much more it scared me, but it made it more real. And I think that, along with this passage of this bill, will get the recognition among a lot of citizens of Alaska, just as it has done with me, of what's going on and what's happening to the citizens of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Guest, did you want to add anything?
Sure, I feel like I'm in the House, so I can say more than my chair. It is not in this bill. What I found in my district and in talking to my constituents is I think they already assume that the sentences are this high. When you actually talk to people and say that someone who rapes a child can get 8 years or someone who molests a child can get 2 and be out in good time, I think the constituents that I talk to, it's shocking. So, unfortunately, I think it's a situation where people are going to ask why we haven't done this up till now. And I go back to just the way that society has always viewed sex crimes, unfortunately. And those including crimes against children. And so I really do think it's in, again, the chair and I sat on Stand Together Against Rape together and have worked on this issue. It really is just an education process about sexual assault and sexual abuse, and then it's not tolerable under any circumstances. And it's unfortunate we have to have that education, but it really is the case. I mean, and you'll hear people say it even on crimes against children where she probably did something to attract that older man. I mean, we haven't gotten there yet. We're slowly getting there. So I think it is much more just as people see what these crimes are about, and as we can talk about these crimes more in our community, that you're going to see, I think, more of a knowledge level and an acceptance level. Because unfortunately, especially with crimes against children, it's a family member. And so you're dealing with family dynamics, community dynamics, in addition to the crime. And I think, unfortunately, with all the publicity around what's gone on with some of our churches, I mean, getting people to talk about these crimes is very, very difficult. But I think when it comes to this bill, I think people already are there, and they're wondering why we haven't been there in the past.
Mike, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to you picked a thread here. That when I presented this bill in Senate Finance, I could hold up a newspaper. There were 3 arrests that had been made that night before on sexual assault. When we went to Senate or House Judiciary, there was something on TV for someone. Just this morning, there was another case of a guy who had been arrested for molesting quite a string of young children, and they're 4 and 5 years old. And so this spotlight will shine a brighter light on those arrests and the vehicles there, the constant arrests, I think, will, and suddenly the defense bar will be very loud about this. We're putting these people away for long periods of time.
Okay. Richardson, could do it.
Thanks. First, I want to thank the sponsors. It's a really difficult and terrible topic, and I want to applaud you for coming forward and shining the light on it. It deserves that. We need to be looking at it. We need to be doing things that are going to help our society help the victims. So my questions are said with the utmost respect for your intent, and I want to understand so that I can make a good decision. But one of the things that I'm concerned about is in the letter of intent, there are a couple statements that I want to understand where they came from, and you know, what are the statistics behind them, because they're very shocking to me. And I worked in this area as a public defender for a long time, so I'm particularly interested in it. On page 3 of the letter of intent, there's the third paragraph there. It says sex offenders average 110 victims and 318 offenses before being caught. And that's a horrific fact, but I can't help but believe that average just sounds way too high to me as just a flat statement. So maybe it's not to the sponsors, maybe it is to others, but since it was your letter of intent, I wanted to raise it while you were here. And there's one other statement. The next paragraph says that they go undetected for an average of 16 years. And again, that for child sexual abuse, that may absolutely be right, horrible as that is. But for all sex offenders, you know, those two statements in the letter of intent did concern me, that maybe those are overstated. It would be better, you know, to just quantify how that works. And so that's the letter of intent, and I did have one or two other questions for the sponsors.
If I could respond just to, initially at least, we spent a good deal of time working on this report, and it is breathtaking in a very negative way. You'll notice that there are footnotes there that the Sex Offender Treatment Evaluation Project report was the basis for this information, and Ms. Parker can provide more detail on that. She was very instrumental in helping us with the research.
And maybe I could get a copy of the report as well. That might help also if I could see it myself. Thank you. The other question of the sponsors, and I think it was Senator Bundy who touched on it, is, and I'll bring it up now, and I know you recognize this is probably an ongoing issue, and I'll bring it up again to others, but it concerns me that some of the sentences are higher than for actually killing a person. And I'm concerned enough to say that, you know, I'd like to know your philosophy behind that, and also my concern is that then we're going to wind up with a time that someone can just kill the victim. And that really makes me worried. So to bring it up now is one of my major concerns.
Mr. Chairman, it's a good question. I'm glad you brought it up because I did allude to it earlier about the proportionality, and I can assure you from taking the last verse that it's not my intent to then seek higher sentences for murder or manslaughter or something like that. And I'll just speak for myself and ask the others to share their opinion. And of course, I would also ask you address the question to Department of Law. But this is the policy call I'm talking about. I'll just go back to what we referred to earlier, that the victims are often sentenced to a life sentence. I have had just anecdotal reports with the people that this stays with them just virtually their entire lives. And sentencing ought to also, or large sentences ought to work as a deterrent. And as Representative Kelly said earlier, when people become more aware of this, we set society standards that this is so abhorrent that in many cases it can be worse than murder, or manslaughter at least, and that we feel so strongly about this, this is a message we're sending out. Don't get involved in this arena. It is going to cost you dearly.
Mr. Chair, if you mind.
Go ahead.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Petula, thank you for that question and the caveats beforehand. It is difficult. When I went back and kind of tried to analytically look at it, because it's a little hard to separate from it emotionally, you know, the interesting thing, there's two things that caught my eye with the current sentencing. One is that, you know, unfortunately, when someone dies, there's multiple ways that can happen, and sometimes that's intentional and sometimes it's unintentional. We don't have any unintentional crimes when it comes to rape and molestation. So for me, I kind of, one of the things I do is separate there. I mean, and it's unfortunate. I mean, one of the things that maybe as policymakers we should think about is if someone dies, do we really care on the other side how it happened? If you look the other way and actually accidentally ran through a stop sign, is that different than pulling out a gun and shooting someone? We've decided as matters of policy that they are, even though the end result's the same. But what we've decided when I look at the sentencing, so let's take, you know, the murder to first degree and second degree murder, is that we make the ranges a lot longer than we do even in this bill. And so we have decided as a matter of policy, and again, this bill is about sexual assault, not about murder, and maybe someone should look at the murder statutes, honestly, because I haven't evaluated those. But what I do see is that we've dealt with the policy of murder by doing a very wide range. It's still a, you know, for second degree, it's a 10-year minimum, and for first degree, it's a 20, but it goes up to 99. without aggravators. I mean, you can get that high, which allows, in some ways, what we're doing at the lower level, allows the courts and the system to kind of look at the crime more closely. And so when I look at the policies that we've set around murder, it seems like we've separated them from intentional and unintentional, and then we've decided to give them as wide of a range as we can on the intentional side to take in circumstances. Is that right or wrong? I don't know. I think it's a good question for, you know, people to ponder. But rape and molestation are intentional crimes, so I think they automatically should be higher. But given that they're not as bad as murder, we don't all go all the way up to 99 on the first time. So when I analytically step back, and then we won't even get into everything you can get in 4 or 5 years, like manslaughter, because we get into all the drug crimes. I mean, 5 years seems to be a minimum for everything. So I kind of take manslaughter and all those things off the table because there's so many things that are at the same level. So that's how I looked at it. It's hard because part of me wants to say we know that someone who's convicted of a first-degree rape or first-degree sexual assault of a minor, which is rape of a child, they're similar crimes, has had multiple victims. I mean, every study you read shows multiple victims, yet we have to set sentencing for a crime, not for multiple crimes. We can't set crimes for the plea bargain, nor do I think we can set crime sentencing for the, well, he'll just plead to it because it's easier than going. You know, the whole things that happen within our system. So for me, I had to sit down and say, do I think crimes of rape should have this minimum, one crime of rape? And for me, I do. I mean, it's a intentionally very, it's a very intentional, a very intentional crime. So that's kind of how I looked at it. You could probably tell me more than I could tell you why there's a 10-year minimum for second-degree murder. And I think probably some victims' families out there would like to know. But I think we make up for it on that because it goes to 99.
Thank you, Ripson. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, just real quickly to address Representative Cretula's questions. Again, it was mentioned earlier about it goes to the 99 years, but that's for a real three strikes you're out type of a crime. But there's two sides to every coin on this. And where you have sentencing where it's 15 to 25 years, and it still costs that victim the rest of their life has to deal with those issues. That's a policy call of both sides of that issue. And you had a question on page 3 of the letter of intent of whether there is an average of 110 victims. But in the next paragraph down there in the first sentence, it says sex offenders go on undetected for an average of 16 years. And that's an average of 16 years. We've got 4,300 sexual offenders in this state. You know, if they go on average of 16 years, I feel that the average of sex offenders, you know, being 110 victims, I think that brings that more into reality. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I just might make one more comment. I thank Representative Cretula for mentioning the letter of intent because that's an integral and important part of this bill, because there surely will be court challenge. And there was a considerable amount of thought, research went into the letter of intent so that when the court challenges do occur, the state of mind, if you will, of the legislature will be clear. And and what we do and say here today, that record will be part of the documentation for those court challenges. So just wanted to add that's why that letter of intent is here.
Let me finish with Representative Cretula's question.
I just had one last one, and I can totally understand the offensive nature of a question like, well, what about a guy in a bar on the sexual contact question, and that is not what I intend. But in terms of the concern that you might have an offense that truly is never even charged under the statute, you know, that we're really not using it. I'm just wondering if, to be certain that it's never misused or abused, we shouldn't try to focus on carving that out formally, rather than leaving it open to this kind of, you know, frankly, I'm sure we're going to hear an attack on the language. So my concern is, why not take care of it? And, you know, I don't have any ideas right now, but just in trying to think of that, because that is a criticism of the bill that I hear, that particular charge, you know, including that language, could be very troublesome.
Can I respond? Through Chair Representative Quiller, too, I appreciate you bringing it up and bringing it up in the manner that you have. I would ask that when Ms. Parks comes up, you talk to her about that. You know, and you've been a DA, and I've never been to law school, so I'm going to let you two kind of discuss it. But what I've been told is the defense attorney can bring up lesser crimes during a trial. And so the crime of harassment, which is what it's charged as now, is how currently it's dealt with. I've never heard a cry from the defense bar up to this point about the mandatory 2 years that grabbing someone in a bar would cause now. And so, yes, I agree, and I agree intellectually. There hasn't been a problem when we've had mandatory jail time now. Could there be in the future? Yes. There could be with the current statute, though, as well. So I have a hard time kind of with that logic that it's something we've got to deal with. If we could, and if you could figure out how to carve out what, you know, what we really deem as harassment now from molestation, I think it would be beneficial. What I'm being told, not being an attorney, is we hurt the molestation when we do that, and I'm not willing to make that trade-off. If it was a problem that we were sending people to jail for 2 years now for touching someone inappropriately in a bar, then I would agree with you that there's a trade-off. But I'm not willing to let child molesters back on the street more quickly because there may be a problem that hasn't shown up yet that we haven't figured out how to legally deal with. And that's the dilemma I'm in. Also, just to go back to the murder in the second degree for one instance, you know, the interesting thing with those cases is that it's the intent to cause physical injury, so you're not intending to kill someone, but you do because you're physical injury, and extreme indifference, conduct that's extreme indifference. So I don't know how you compare those with intentionally raping someone. I mean, and that's really when we get into the 10 years, you know, that how can a rape be more than a second degree murder when you know it's an intentional rape, it's an unintentional act with extreme indifference that causes a murder. I don't know if those are, but I know that I think the values of the state say that someone should be going away for a long time for a rape. So I just want to get back to you on that. When you look at the murder 2 statute, I think it's again, it's a series of policy calls, but I think this bill does the right one.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and again, I thank Representative Petullo for bringing up these good questions because they do need to be addressed. Now, Mr. Chairman, if we could write a perfect law, we could get rid of our courts because it would, every instance, every aggravator, every mitigator would be taken care of, and we simply wouldn't need courts. I've heard some of the same criticism that Representative Tool has had, and coming from the defense bar, and it somewhat amazes me that they have so little faith in our system, apparently, of one, prosecutorial discretion. And you will hear from a former prosecutor that these kinds of crimes, and evidence shows they don't get reported very often, and they don't get prosecuted. But if they are prosecuted, we have a judge and we have a jury that addresses these issues. And as severe as these sentences may be, I want to remind the committee that a single mitigator can cut them in half. So we have these balances we go through, But I will acknowledge that we cannot write a perfect law. And I side with Senator Guess in saying, if we're going to err, let's err on greater protection, because it doesn't appear at this point there have been abuse. If there is, then perhaps that's further work.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to defer back to the fact again that perpetrators of sexual crimes have done this many times over. You know, the person who's willing to go up and grab a person, grab a woman's breast in the bar, probably done other types of sexual crimes, the likelihood of it. But, you know, so they. You ask, is this too severe in some of these? I don't think so. Just the facts are there.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Anything else, Representative Cool?
No, I want to thank the panel because I think it's a difficult topic and I really appreciate the answers, and I'll just be seeking their thoughts and advice as we go forward. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Stoll.
Mr. Chairman, I'd prefer away from Ms. Parks. More appropriate.
Okay. Representative Kelly.
I guess just one comment. Well, the thing that I'm sure caused you to tackle this and why the numbers are so high is we can't fix these monsters. We don't do it. But, you know, we seem to fix a lot of long sentence type people and be able to turn them back out and have some hope that it'll work. But from what I understand, these are some of the non-fixables, which is, I think, why we're stuck with it. I'm like Representative Cotulla. You have to go through this exercise, but I keep coming back to the fact that why are we sticking them away for a long time? Because as soon as they're out, they go back to work. And that's part of why I'm willing to join the crowd that puts them away and says that's the only way we can deal with you. We don't seem to do well otherwise. It's more a comment than a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and a fair comment. We, in our research, it indicates that there's some slight success in rehabilitation for males who are involved in incest, and if they will, and it's a very difficult program. If they stick through the program, through their entire sentence, there's some small success rate. And the other factor, from my cynical side, may be, well, their kids have grown up by the time they get out. But there's little success rate, and. And Representative Cotulla's right. This is difficult things to talk about. I have to talk about sexual penetration of a minor, and it's not something you usually deal with in polite company. But I just have to use myself as an example. We're all born with a certain sexuality, and no amount of counseling could convince me to have sex with children. Those who are inclined to have sex with children, I don't believe any amount of counseling will convince them to not do that. And you are exactly right. The only treatment that we know of, in a broad sense right now, is to protect the victim, prevent future abuse, and that means we have to subject these people to long sentences.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I wanted to bring up two points and offer something to Mr. Kelly if he wants it. There's a recent article that came out that was the first academic study that would randomly assign sex offenders to treatment and non-treatment in California and trace them for 15 years. And it was unfortunate, I think, for those of us that wish treatment that would work and that would be the answer, that there wasn't a statistical difference between the two groups. Can we say then that treatment doesn't work and we can't fix these guys? That's a policy discussion for another day, but it was a pretty riveting article, very academic, but if anyone wants a copy, I can provide that for them. It is the case, though, and, you know, one of the key provisions because of the sentencing that gets overlooked in the bill is the automatic probation and polygraph section. Because actually, it right now is the best practice not only to protect people, but to help people who have been convicted of these crimes to not do them again. And it's right now the best practice of helping them is oftentimes, especially with people who sexually assault children, there's a pattern and there's a grooming. And if you can help stop them from going down that path. And again, in Colorado, the polygraph has been shown to be very effective, not foolproof, but very effective in people knowing that they're going to have to go in for the polygraph, that they're not going to be able to pass it, and therefore not going by the schoolyard, not buying a puppy, not going down that road to create another victim. So I think in some ways we both, you know, to me it's, does the punishment fit the crime regardless of treatment? And to me it's yes. Can we treat these individuals? It's becoming harder and harder to figure out how effectively. Do we do, I think, the best job in this bill to address that? I actually think the polygraph section does that and gives the Department of Corrections some discretion of who they use it on, but helping people not go down that road. So that section is actually, I think, very helpful in that regard.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
in reference to Representative Kelly, and I don't know quite how the polygraph tests have played into these recidivism rates, but I'm assuming that you've probably helped bring them down or help them considerably. But incest, 4 to 10%, and rape is 7 to 35%. Child molesters with female victims, 10 to 29%, and child molesters with male victims, 13 to 40%. These people just do not learn, and you're right. The only way to deal with these monsters, as you say, is to put them behind bars.
Okay. Very good. Well, Mr. Chairman, I know you're going to move on, but the polygraph came up, and I know Representative Chenault had a question, and I just wanted to point out, and when I'd like Portia Parker, when she comes, to be able to put it on the record that they are currently using, when they use a polygraph, people who are trained in this arena, and I'd encourage them to establish by regulation that anyone who administers this has to be trained in that area, and allows them then to change and develop their requirements as technology changes. Whether if we put it in a statute and require a specific training, maybe that's too inflexible, and it's current practice and just acknowledge it should be in regulation may meet the concerns that have been made.
Okay, very good. Thank you, all three of you, for coming here and testifying. I would like to go on to public testimony, because I'm assuming we can get you guys back when we need to be. And I think we do have Portia Parker and Susan Parks here to testify. But I'm going to go to some of these other folks here that I think may have difficulty joining us another day. But Sue Ann Williams, would you join us, please? You're with Spirit Village, is that correct? Okay. Very good. You could, for the record, tell us your name and affiliation, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Sue Ann Williams, and I'm actually here to read a testimony for Bob Lusher, who cannot be here today because he's having foot surgery.
Okay.
So I'm just going to go ahead and read the testimony.
All right, fine.
Spirit Village, Inc. is a nonprofit corporation organized to promote facilities and programming for reentry of prison inmates back into the Alaska community and for the promotion of the establishment of correction facilities to house all prisoners within the state of Alaska. With this in mind, our organization is interested in all aspects of the management of corrections activities within the state of Alaska. Our board of directors' attention has been drawn to Senate Bill 218 and the requirements of the polygraph testing of sexual offenders who are under the direct supervision of the Department of Corrections within the prisons and halfway houses or on probation and parole. The polygraph testing is utilized as a rehabilitation tool to monitor and provide guidance to such persons and to protect the public. We support this requirement and believe that it is in the public interest. However, we believe that the polygraph testing of sexual offenders should be undertaken by qualified examiners who have been trained and received certifications and continuing education to provide such examinations. Towards this end, we recommend the standards and requirements of the American Polygraph Association Academy and their program certification requirements for a post-conviction sex offender polygraph course. Additionally, we believe that persons administering such polygraph testing within or outside of the Department of Corrections must have such qualifications and certifications if they are going to be administering such tests. There is an amendment, a suggested amendment, attached in the back of this letter.
Okay, very good. We'll keep this handy as we go through the bill, and we'll take up amendments at the very end after public testimony. Is there any questions?
Representative Stoltz. Can I just ask what Spirit Village is and what's the role in the issue of sexual offenders? Or
Spirit Village is a recent nonprofit organization developed to have programs for prisoners reentering back into the community. It's still in the works, but they're interested in helping people get back into the community.
Is it culturally based program? Is that
some culturally based and some common practices?
Okay. Well, thanks. I just couldn't tell you later. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. You. Okay, let's go to Nicole Songer at the Cordova Family Resource Center. We're going.
Ew. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
Okay, thank you. My name is Nicole Songer, and I am the Executive Director of the Cordova Family Resource Center. And I wanted to take the time to thank all of those sponsors on this bill. Working with many victims of sexual assault, whether it be children or adults, it is very important to hold the sex offender accountable. And I don't need to go over statistics. It sounds like you guys have all of that very well taken care of. So I just wanted to encourage you guys to support this bill, and thank you for all of your time.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you very much. Okay, next we're going to go to Nome. No place like Nome. Sue Christensen.
Hello, this is Sue Christensen. I work at the Bering Sea Women's Group as an administrative assistant, but I'm here today for myself. The first thing I'd like to address is the Senator Guest brought this up. The difference between the bar scene and an adult woman being harassed and a child who is molested or a victim of incest is noted because the child is a captive or a dependent and defenseless. Most often there are children 3-4 years old who can't string more than 3 or 4 words together to form a sentence. So I would suggest that a law be passed that addresses vulnerable child protection of children 10 years and younger, so that the molestation through clothing addresses them specifically. Another thing I'd like to mention quickly is if we were to front-load services to sexual assault victims instead of ignoring them, we would have less mental illness, addictions, children being placed in foster care later on, dysfunctional adults, addicts, and I really feel that our jails and prisons are full of children who were raped or molested as kids. And by ignoring those kids, that's what we end up getting. The other thing I'd like to mention is that if there's a higher sentence for killing a person, because I was a child of incest, I would like to inform some of the people that child sexual assault kills or alters a child's core, the way that the child was born to be. In many instances, it is a death sentence. The next thing I'd like to talk about briefly is our national law. If you look up ageofconsent.com on internet, you will find that most states have the age of consent between 16 and 18 years old. If you look up teen marriage laws by state, you will find that children 13 and 14 13 and 14, that is girls 13, boys 14, can marry in many states, and that in other states there is no minimum age for a girl to marry if she is pregnant or already, or if she has already given birth to a child. So that those states become havens for pedophiles who wish to marry their victim and keep them silent. Then the final thing I would like to mention is on the child kidnapping section, there wasn't a definition. So I suppose for the purpose of the discussion, you're talking about kidnapping for human trafficking, income exploitation, sexual assault, child pornography, snuff films, torture, prostitution. But you're not distinguishing between a child kidnapped by a biological non-custodial parent or a family member who kidnaps a child away from an addictive parent. And I just wanted some clarification on that. So with that, I will just be quiet. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. I think some of your questions or concerns will get answered as we continue through the process here. Okay. I'd like to go on now to let's go to Brenda Stanfield with the Center for Nonviolent Living. I'm sorry?
She's not online.
Okay. How about Quinlan Steiner? Quinlan Steiner?
Hi, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
This is Quinlan Steiner. I represent the Public Defender Agency. I'm the director of the agency. And I just wanted to make one comment on the bill with respect to Section 2, and I've testified on this before, that as written, there creates an irreconcilable conflict with our rules of professional conduct that would prevent us from representing individuals who were previously convicted of a sex crime. I'm currently working with Susan Parks of the Department of Law. We're developing language that would kind of maintain the substance of that section of the statute while resolving the ethical conflict. And I think that we will likely find some language that will work for both of us. But that's what we're currently working on, so I just wanted the committee to be aware. I'd be happy to answer any questions on that if anyone would like.
All right. Any questions for our public defender? Seeing none. Thank you very much for staying with us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to Homer, Ginger Bryant.
Hi, this is Ginger Bryant, and I'm with South Peninsula Haven House here in Homer. And we in the agency would just like to be on the record as adamantly for this bill. We work with victims after victim after victim from the same person. We put their lives back together. We try to get them on the right road as much as we can. We know these ghosts will be with them forever. And it just is heartbreaking when you see it time and time again. Grandpa gets out, and then the next generation gets it. Uncle returns back, and then you have a whole new set of neighbor kids who are now the victims. By nature, they are not forthcoming. It is a crime that is done in silence. Children are suffering in silence, and without polygraphs and other ways to hold these people accountable, it continues, and it will continue. This is a crime that is insidious, and it will not stop unless we put the people behind bars and hold them accountable with everything that we have in our arsenal to do it. And we would love to see this bill go through. Thank you very much for bringing it, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ginger. Appreciate the testimony. Thank you for staying with us.
You bet.
Okay, let's go on now to Christine Krennick in Bethel.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I just want to say that, first of all, I represent the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel, and I agree with what everyone said about this bill, because the perpetrators go in and out of jail, and there's a lot of turnarounds where the perpetrator does this over and over, and there should be a longer jail sentence time or rehabilitation time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Steve. Okay, is there anyone else online that wanted to testify? Okay. Very good. Then, let's see. I have Rex. Did you want to testify today or when we bring this back up?
If you have the time today, sure. I'll do it.
I think you might get more time if you can wait until... I think we could bring this back up Monday. Is that correct? Okay.
It's personal testimony versus the bill of testimony.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay.
That'd be fine. And then what we'll do on Monday when we bring this bill back up is I'll ask Portia Parker and Susan Parks both have testimony, and then they're also here for questions when we, at that time, revisit the bill and then open it up for questions from the committee members. Mr. Shattuck, go ahead, sir.
For the record, my name is Rex Shattuck. I am staff to Representative Newman. I did work on the bill. However, this is personal testimony that I'd like to give. I'd like to thank the committee, Mr. Chairman, and your co-chair and the other members of this committee for addressing this issue. It affects more people than you know. It affects people that you do know. I'd like to thank the sponsors in both the House and the Senate for their work on it, and for those that have spent some long hours answering questions, Lauren Rice, Bush Parker, and Mrs. Parker from the Department of Law. The reason why I wanted to testify is because you'll not hear many people step forward and perhaps testify as victims of this. And I can give personal testimony on this particular issue. I thought long and hard before I gave testimony in judiciary. But I think it's important for somebody, at least from the perspective of a victim, to address this issue. It is policy that you are talking about, however, and I know you are very well aware that there are individuals that are impacted by it. I would say that the numbers seem very realistic to me, to Representative Krutula, in the particular occurrence that I am speaking to. I'm probably lucky in so much that it was a Class B felony, if we want to talk in terms of what we call the sentencing and all. I know of five other individuals who were impacted by this particular perpetrator, a person in a position of authority, not an individual who was a member of a family, not even somebody I particularly knew other than from the position of authority that they were in. Until really recently, working on this bill, my boss, Representative Newman, was not aware of my having been impacted by this legislation, and it wasn't until it actually came before the House I felt obligated to an awful lot of folks who wouldn't be willing to testify to give personal insight into it. There are a lot of technical aspects that Senator Bundy and Senator Gass and Representative Newman, as well as Department of Law and Corrections, will be able to testify to in after me. But the one thing that I would like to bring forward and put a face on is this. The sentencing at present is 2 to 4 years for a Class B felony. Even if you pass this legislation, you're looking at 5 to 15 years potentially. And as an individual who has dealt with this, I have dealt with this for 35 years. I deal with it well. 35 years versus a victim, versus the perpetrator being perhaps put in incarceration for 5 to 15 years. When you talk about comparing this to murder, and I don't mean to sound crass, but there's a finality in one and there's not in the other. I've had to deal with it for 35 years, whereas the perpetrator would have dealt with it a lot less time. I would ask that you remember that. I know that it's a difficult subject, and I appreciate the you all dealing with it. But that's the one aspect that a victim deals with that may be hard to relate to. And it is an epidemic, and it is important to address this. It is important to send a very strong signal to those who would contemplate this. And I appreciate your consideration of this, and I would urge you to pass this. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sayre. Yes, Representative.
Yeah, I want to thank you for your testimony, and since you mentioned me, I want you to know how very sorry I am for you personally, and that my questions are meant so that we can have a better and stronger law, not in any way for anything else. I want a law that will succeed and that will help victims.
To the chair, I appreciate that, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Shattuck, for your testimony today. Okay, is there anybody else here in the audience who wants to testify? Okay, seeing none, and there's no one else online. Let's go ahead and close the public testimony, but we'll certainly invite and want Ms. Parker and Ms. Parks, the two P's, to testify, and then obviously as Deputy Director of Corrections and as Deputy Attorney General, we'll have lots of questions for you. So we will invite you back Monday to testify on this. I think this will have to wait till Monday. Friday, I believe, we're going to get booted out of here again, either for LBNA or House Resources.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
As much as I might not agree with it philosophically, I would hope that also the public defender would also be invited back to offer
sure.
balance. Just
okay. Yes. Is the public defender, are you still online, sir? Mm-hmm. Quit on it? Can we make sure he gets invited? He's invited testimony also. So we'll have those three. Okay. We'll have those three testify. Otherwise, we'll close public testimony on this bill. Like I said, we will bring this back up on Monday. So for tomorrow, let's see. Tomorrow we have House Bill 408, Definition of Child Abuse and Neglect. House Bill 12, TVs and Monitors in the Motor Vehicles. House Bill 338, Certificate of Fitness for the Elderly Co-Chairman of Finance. Oh, you know, we do have a birthday. I almost forgot. Good thing. Are you up for it, Joyce?
Sure.
Okay. Just a minute. And then also we have, House Bill 338, which is the my elderly friend here, Bill, is a Certificate of Fitness for Explosive Handlers. Jeez. Okay. And then we'll also any of the previous heard or scheduled bills, but we probably won't have time except for those. So, okay, Representative Foster, anything, any comments you want to make? Okay.
Good. Well, they're gone now, the sponsors are gone. I did have one concern. You know, this is a good bill and everything, but looking at the fiscal note, and you know, I happen to think that most of the budget subcommittee chairmen are proud of their departments. Like I've had DOT for 14 years in the military. Everybody's saying on the budget subcommittee, DOT's got top old stuff, so they come over and they advocate for roads and better runways. And the military committee, budget subcommittee's got veterans. They want to go there and help that department serve veterans. But, you know, typically there's never anybody here that cares anything about courts, and they got to walk around every year with a tin can while we nickel and dime them, and when we pass fiscal notes like this, and they've got nobody here really to advocate for them next year and the year after on their overall budget. So once we pass this thing, I think they'll be coming in for, like, not supplemental, but they're going to have a hard time trying to, you know, we'll see. I think this fiscal note is probably quite a bit less than what's going to be really required when you're taking somebody and making them stay in jail for 25 years or whatever it is, or 50 years. And so that's my concern is the budget part of this. I think it's a fine bill. I just don't see the legislature in years from now, you know, really addressing the money part of this.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Representative Foster, and I think those are valid points that we should bring up when we bring the bill back up on Monday. So at this time, before we adjourn, Joyce, can you lead us in a happy birthday song?
I'll take the lower key.
Yeah, you can sing too.
Let's see.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
co-chair.
Happy birthday to you.
Yes. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any final
Thank
remarks?
Thank goodness that this only happens once a year.
Yeah.
That's twice, one day, four times in 3 days.
We love you.
I appreciate everyone's thoughts.
Okay. Do you still have birthday cake?
I don't know. I had a little kid in the office a while ago, and I don't know if everybody...
Probably. Yeah, I thought I saw somebody bouncing off the walls here. Right? Okay. Anything else? Okay, we're adjourned.
Oh, I can't go.